frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUDN, WVUDH D1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on September 15th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel joins me to talk about the recent U.S. prison strike and the lack of evacuations for inmates ahead of the recent hurricane. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So we're going to be talking about the prison strike, which we had done an episode before it happened, letting people know that it was going to be happening. Now it's wrapped up, and so we wanted to talk about sort of how it went down and some of the coverage and things like that. Also, you know, this was something that was organized in large part by the organization, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and the IWOC is part of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which we've talked quite a bit about in the historical context of the work that they were doing in the early 20th century, especially with various organizing actions. Rachel, let's talk about this prison strike that just happened. As I said, you gave us a preview of what was expected before it happened, but now we're at the end of it. Where do we start on that?
So The Guardian had a pretty good write-up, just kind of tying everything together. So they talked about the significance of the dates. The strike started on August 21st, which was the 47th anniversary of the death of Black Panther member George Jackson, who was shot as he tried to escape in San Quentin in California. And then it wrapped up on September 9th, which was the anniversary of the Attica prison uprising in upstate New York. So they just kind of wanted to mark those two very important dates in the inmate rights movement. So it didn't really seem to get a lot of coverage. The Guardian did a really good job keeping people posted and kind of reminding people of the action as it unfolded. There were unconfirmed reports of 10 states getting involved, as well as one province, Nova Scotia in Canada. So there was a video of an inmate refusing food in California, stating that he was on a hunger strike in Tacoma, where there's a prison and also an immigrant detention center. The immigrants were sending out a message of solidarity with the inmates as well. Florida, South Carolina, although Florida did release a press statement saying that there were no reports of any action at whatsoever. So they were definitely trying to minimize the impact of their inmates rising up in solidarity with this action. So there was some retaliation. The Guardian spoke with Eddie, a prisoner who has served 13 years of an 18-year sentence in South Carolina. He spoke saying they suspended all recreation so that we are in our cells literally 24/7 They turn back our mail, threaten anyone found to be associated with the strike with solitary, and they've painted windows in our cells black, so we have no idea whether it's night or day. However, he said it did not dampen the spirits or dissuade the inmates as they are planning future actions. Other retaliation was against one of the prominent strike organizers, Kevin Rashid Johnson. He wrote an opinion piece for The Guardian at the beginning of the prison strike. He was summoned to appear in front of authorities in Sussex State Prison in Waverly, Virginia, where he's currently being held in solitary confinement. He's been told that he faces transfer to a different penitentiary, following a pattern in which he has been moved around the country from prison to prison, from Virginia to Oregon, Texas, Florida, and back to Virginia. Prison officials are trying to neutralize him by moving him around so he can't establish ties with other prisoners in the prisons and do political education work. While strike leaders are primed for further retaliation, they're also developing a campaign to restore voting rights, which was the 10th demand on the list of demands that they published prior to the strike starting. It seems like Florida is kind of the epicenter of this. They have a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November, whether they want voting rights to be restored to people with felony convictions who have fully served their sentences and completed parole or probation. Florida is definitely one of the most important swing states, with the potential to decide presidential elections. 2000, obviously. Donald Trump won in 2016 with a majority over Hillary Clinton of just 113,000 votes. And if voting rights were restored, some 1.5 million Floridians would be brought back on the voting rolls, which would definitely have a huge impact. The Guardian article also talked about Crystal Mason in Texas, who is facing a return to federal prison for 10 months after she cast a provisional ballot in the 2016 presidential election. She's not aware at the time that as a former felon, she was prohibited from voting. I believe we've talked about that before, but that just kind of shows the two factions kind of battling it out. Republicans are definitely trying to keep prisoners ex-cons from voting. These prison rights people are trying to overturn a lot of these laws. I think we've spoken before, like about 36 states put some sort of long-term stay on voting rights. Oftentimes they don't get restored until after people have paid fines or are completely free from parole or probation. And just a few states allow incarcerated people to vote at all. I think Maine and one other state, correct?
It's a very limited number of states, but I believe we went over the state by state stuff in the previous episode where we talked about this, so people can refer back to that one
right,
for the details. Or Brennan Center for Justice always keeps pretty good records of this stuff, publishes it for people, so you can check that out there.
Right. So I think this is definitely one aspect that has the potential to maintain momentum and actually grow as a movement. I think enough people are focused on voting rights and restoring voting rights for as many people as possible, and making sure voter suppression is kept down. So I think that's definitely one aspect. The New Yorker also published a statement from an incarcerated person. Obviously anonymous, fear because he feared retaliation by prison officials. He kind of talked about how people get informed about these actions. He said the information gets out by word of mouth and it spreads. Somebody on lockup might get word up to somebody on the yard with a little note. We call them kites, sending up a kite. Other times you might not know something and then it shows up on the news and it sparks interest in everybody. It spreads like wildfire in some cases. He also said in South Carolina, where he is currently incarcerated, he's going on a spending strike. They're not spending any money with the state, if at all possible. Some people are doing medical strikes, refusing to take their medications. He said about 30% of the inmates at his facility were striking. So that's kind of, that's pretty encouraging. I think that's a pretty good percentage of people, especially with the fear of retaliation from.
Well, and
from,
he said that it was more than half initially before some of the, you know, crackdowns or people who lost interest or whatever. So, yeah.
Right. So I would say the fear of retaliation is pretty strong, but it is encouraging to see enough people joining in. He also talked about the conditions in his prison.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those conditions. I was hoping you could highlight some of those things, you know, in sort of general conditions. And then after that, we'll talk about some of the more recent things in the news.
Right. So in his statement, he said they have two men in cells designed for one man. They put plates over the windows so they can't see outside. 90% of the rooms don't have any lockers, chairs, or tables. The top bunk is almost 6 feet from the ground. There's no ladder. So men, their late 40s or older, are trying to access the top bunks to sleep on, and they're inaccessible. The building is brick and old, and it has bad plumbing. He said every weekend, the water, I don't know what happens to it, but it smells like sewer. We can't really drink it. We wouldn't chance it. So we save a little water to drink on the weekends. They give us little containers we can fill up. So it's just, it's pretty discouraging. And also, he said, for most of us that's going home, we're going to leave in the state that we came and that's broke. We're going to be destitute. We won't even have cab fare. They only give us a bus ticket, so we have to fend for ourselves. We're faced with the same dilemma that landed us in prison in the first place. Yeah, the conditions are terrible. And this is in South Carolina. And South Carolina is in the news right now because it's in the path of Hurricane Florence. It's getting really bad weather right now. And South Carolina is one of the states where there was a mandatory evacuation notice. The governor released an evacuation notice, and there's a prison in the evacuation area that is refusing to evacuate their prisoners. So we just wanted to highlight that. There's a medium security prison called McDougal Correctional. It has 651 inmates who can do nothing but wait for the storm to hit. The Department of Corrections tweeted out a photo, I believe, and
Sandbags that they had. They made them fill the sandbags because, of course, right. While we're talking about this prison strike, like, let's just remind everyone that a lot of these prisons, especially in the South, are using these prisoners as a huge labor force for very, very low pay, you know, cents on the dollar, basically, per hour.
Right.
And in this case, they were making them fill their own sandbags to protect the prison they were in from potentially getting flooded.
Right. I think they had them fill like 35,000 sandbags. Brian Sterling, the director of the South Carolina Department of Corrections, that told the New Yorker that they're not moving McDougal residents because prison evacuation posed, quote, logistical challenges and public safety concerns. However, North Carolina and Virginia have already evacuated prisoners in high-risk zones. Sterling's decision comes in the wake of a nationwide prison strike catalyzed by a deadly riot and inhumane conditions in South Carolina's prisons. In light of South Carolina's choice to leave McDougal as it is, an inmate told the New Yorker that his fellow prisoners would be left to drown, quote, if it rained enough. So this just really ties into the reason the prisoners were striking in the first place, and especially the conditions in South Carolina, which kicked off the prison strike a year earlier than they initially planned, just because it was so egregious in South Carolina.
You know, I just wanted to say, like, that, like, let's also keep in mind that a lot of these people are in for very minor crimes that they've been convicted of, or in many cases they're in pretrial detention and they haven't been convicted of anything. The notion that, like, you can just leave people to die, I mean, they're not facing a death sentence, and you're just saying, well, these are expendable people that we can potentially leave to drown. And, like, that's not, I don't know if you wanted to talk about some of the highlighted incidents, I think, in the Vice article that you had about previous ones. I mean, we've talked about some of them on the show, especially at the anniversary of Katrina, talked about some of the stuff that happened in Katrina. And then certainly we talked last year about all the ones in Puerto Rico and the South when those multiple hurricanes hit in a row, about what happened to some of those people. The Katrina thing in particular is just so horrifying because, you know, not only did like 500 people go missing and were never accounted for, in many cases drowning, but also like, there was a juvenile pretrial detention where these were children who hadn't been convicted of anything who were being left and they almost drowned. I think they survived, but they were like up to their necks or something in water, like just absolutely horrifying.
Right. There were more than 100 teenage inmates, and they were left almost fully submerged in dirty flood water and were left without food or water for days. In some places, women and men prisoners were locked up together, which definitely creates dangerous conditions for more vulnerable populations. The flood waters reached as high as 6 feet. So I'm only 5'4". I'm sure the average woman prisoner is about that height. So if the floodwater in your cell is higher than you are tall, obviously you're going to be in grave danger. Another inmate recalled seeing dead bodies floating on floor waters by the medical center. So a lot of these prisoners were locked in their cells for days thinking they were going to die. So it adds another layer of cruel punishment for these prisoners. I know we spoke before the prison strike, the stated aim of our carceral state is rehabilitation, but I it's easy to see the way we treat these prisoners is so disposable and don't evacuate them. It definitely puts the lie to that. We're just punishing them for no, like in really cruel and unusual ways. I think leaving people to think that they're going to drown to death is definitely falls under that cruel and unusual punishment.
I mean, it's like Jean Valjean level, just like right. 24601, you know, for stealing bread. Like it's that level of like.
And McDougal is only a medium security facility, so it's people that have done less violent crimes and aren't a danger to the general population. And they say that it's so dangerous to move prisoners because then we're exposing people to the risk that prisoners are going to escape.
Yeah, I guess they just assume that anytime they move prisoners, they're going to get heisted by Bane or the Joker. Like,
right, yeah. Like,
Someone's going to, anytime they approach a cross intersection, they're going to get hit from the side by a speeding SUV and it's going to flip over the bus and there's going to be thousands of escaping prisoners every time. That is without fail when you move the prisoners every time.
So it's just really awful reading about these prisoners being left behind and how they're kind of just preparing themselves to maybe die in this storm. So it's very, very discouraging to read about these statements from the Department of Corrections. And I think for a public servant to say basically that prisoners are disposable is just, it's really shocking to me.
I was also going to say, you know, we talked at the beginning briefly about the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which was responsible for this big strike this year. They had also organized one in 2016 for the 45th anniversary of the Attica uprising. That was 24,000 prisoners in 24 states, which was, according to Wikipedia, the largest prison strike in U.S. history. And so, like, that, I think, probably laid the groundwork for some of the, like, containment responses that a lot of these prisons were. I mean, you were alluding to the fact that Florida was sort of just lying and saying that there wasn't anything happening. But you know, they followed up this year with this strike that was also big, but maybe a little bit smaller breadth because of all the efforts. There were some of the articles mentioned that some of the places had been on lockdown for literally months ahead of this, in order to like prevent them from organizing. And one of the other things that I noticed in the coverage of this, and I don't know if you want to speak to that as well, is that a lot, like even one of the articles that you linked to refers to the details coming out as sketchy, and that they weren't sure what was happening. And I noticed that, and I don't remember this being the case in 2016. Maybe people just, maybe the reporters weren't paying as much attention because they were more focused on like the 2016 election, I guess, because it was like September. There was a lot of internal clashes happening in the discourse around this strike, where you had a bunch of journalists basically openly complaining that they couldn't get anyone to tell them what was happening. And they're not people who normally work on the prisons and jails beat. And so the journalists who did work on that typically were pretty frustrated, or just activists who are involved in advocating for prisoners and inmates. They were upset with the other reporters, the non-beat reporters, for the way that they were handling this, because they're like, well, I mean, you have to build like trust with your sources, which you have to do anyway generally, but it's like very difficult when, as all these articles that you link to highlight, like most of this is coming out on like illegal smuggled cell phones that they're getting like in touch with people that way. Like and the fact that they were putting all these places on lockdown for months, like that's very difficult to not only organize internally, but get any word out about what's happening. A lot of these articles that you've included talk about like, you know, word leaking out in letters to the, family members and stuff like that, or, you know, things like that, like just a very slow sort of trickle of information. And you had a lot of reporters who were like, typically working this beat, were like, why do all these people want anonymity? And it's like, well, because of the guy who did the op-ed under his own name keeps getting moved around to like five different states because they're punishing him. Like, you know, it's very obvious why these people would want anonymity. I found that sort of like discussion around the way this was being covered and discussed like very odd. I don't know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, in the New Yorker article, it name checks Mr. Sterling, the director of the Department of Corrections in South Carolina, obviously a big figure in this discussion. He said that he wants to get rid of the cell phones out of prison so that inmates can focus on rehabilitation. But the only thing that keeps an inmate sane is the cell phone. He said, most of us, we do good with our phones. If we have them, we look up law. We look up how other prisons are run. So if it gets out that an inmate has a phone and is using it to contact the press or other inmates or family members, obviously they're going to get their phone taken away. So that's definitely something that the media has to keep in mind. Obviously, like, you want to stay anonymous or else you'll definitely get retaliated against, get your phone taken away, which is your lifeline. Especially as we spoke about before, when prison libraries aren't really a thing anymore, you have to have something to occupy your time and to be an outlet and an escape in these conditions. So obviously they don't want to get their phones taken away by releasing statements with their names attached. And yeah, definitely when we see these strike organizers getting moved around and getting shunted from prison to prison, That definitely has a dampening effect on fellow prisoners who see this and know that it could happen to them as well.
All right. So, Rachel, why don't you wrap this up for us? What are your sort of closing thoughts on this?
I'm kind of encouraged by how many outlets did report on this. I saw an article from Teen Vogue. There are some media outlets that you don't typically see talking about this. And I think that's very encouraging. However, I would have liked to have seen more coverage of this event, this action. And I hope to see further discussion of about voting rights, and especially if that's kind of the facet that prison organizers want to latch onto and kind of expand on. I hope the media really shines a spotlight on this as well. And kind of highlighting, as hurricane seasons get longer and more severe, I think we definitely need to shine a light on prisons that do not evacuate and name check the officials that make these decisions that affect these prisoners and often lead to their injury and death. So I think we just need to definitely keep a spotlight trained on these events.
Yeah, they keep, I mean, they're in the Carolinas or Florida or Louisiana or Texas or whatever, and they're acting like they don't have a contingency plan for this. Like, as if a hurricane has never happened and that would be unprecedented. It's like, come on.
Right, yeah. Especially South Carolina. Like, they've had some really big hurricanes over the last few years. And Hurricane Harvey last year. So they definitely need the media there definitely needs to really kind of browbeat these officials and really hammer them on these evacuation plans and contingency plans that are in place.
All right, Rachel, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.